3 small pieces of metal sandwiched together repeatedly to make a layer of 24, and then back to 1. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a program devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. My co-host Stephen DeLuque and I bring it to you the first and second Wednesday of each month. We produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today we continue with our guest, Steve Midgett, who is an internationally recognized jeweler and goldsmith whose specialty is Mokume Gane. This process was originated in Japan centuries ago, and Steve and others have done much to bring it to life here in the States and in other countries around the world. A very simple composition could be sterling silver and copper layered to 14 to 24 layers and fused in a small kiln. That blank, or what we call a billet, is then forged and rolled out back to a much thinner metal that can be used to construct pieces of art. The patterns and the multiple colors can vary quite a bit, but it takes a lot of practice to develop exactly what you're after. This interview took place in 2012 at a National Metalsmithing Conference in Seattle, Washington. Part 1 of this program, which aired last week, can be heard by visiting the KCBX website. Here now is Part 2 with guest Steve Midgett. I have done very little work with gold or platinum, and so I was interested to find out from Steve what his experiences have been in learning about these metals. What did you find was the learning curve for you on working with the what we're really calling the precious metals?
Yeah.
Gold and platinum. And
you mean for a laminate? For a laminate
and just even working them in terms of how they move, what they do, as opposed to how silver moves.
Right. Well, in general, you know, they normally are a little bit harder, but I don't find any real great difference between them. And even the platinum, I know there's, you know, a lot of people say you have to keep all your tools separate and everything, but I don't really do that and haven't had too much of a problem because of that. But as far as laminating materials, I did do pretty extensive research into using different gold alloys. That got quite expensive because I made a lot of mistakes.
And if it was expensive then, folks, hate to think what it would be now.
Yeah, you're much better off buying my book and following the directions in that. Yeah, any red or pink gold that has a high amount of copper, those are problematic because they tend to form a very large grain structure when you're doing a firing, because the metal is at an elevated temperature for a long time, and it allows the crystal structure of the metal to grow. And when a piece of metal has a large crystal structure, basically the impurities that are in the metal get forced to the boundaries of these crystals within the metal, and they get concentrated there, which makes weak places in the metal, and then it will crack apart there. So red golds do that. Nickel white golds are just beastly to work with. I've ruined several billets trying to work with them, so I no longer work with them. Palladium white golds would be the way to go with that. And, of course, platinum and palladium, they have their own issues because they're very high melting temperature. And I find that it needs to be a very high temperature firing to get those metals to bond properly and good pressure holding them together.
Once you've gone through a lot of this experimentation over the years, you referenced earlier and we didn't follow up on it, how would you describe the style of what you do what excites you in terms of creating pattern and ideas and work?
I think as far as pattern goes, I've been very fascinated with natural kind of patterns, animal skin patterns. I've done like snake patterns that have the pattern of a rattlesnake or a copperhead or different animal skins. And I feel like the material really references the natural world. And that is the way that we connect with it. We have sort of an inherent aesthetic that comes from our natural world. When I teach, there is a sensitivity to pattern that develops over time. And when people start out, you can pretty much always tell where somebody's at in their process by looking at their patterning, because there are some easy ways of doing things that are usually explored first. And then as you become more sensitive to the pattern and develop your technique, you can create patterns that are much more pleasing visually. And to me, that almost always involves the flow of the material. And even though it might not be a natural pattern, it's a pattern that becomes accessible to us because of our aesthetic that is based on the natural world.
Just a quick vocabulary fill-in here before Steve talks about his own work. The field of metalsmithing has three basic categories: jewelry, flatware, which is utensils, and hollowware, which encompasses containers, chalices, boxes, that type of thing. The process of raising is one of taking a disc of metal, let's say a millimeter thick, and hammering it so that it is compressed, and slowly it raises into a bowl shape. There are no seams in it, so it's different from some other construction. Last night, we were looking at three of your pieces that are in an exhibit. One of them is a raised vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of you more in the jewelry line. So is that combination of working what we call hollowware been a regular part of what you do, or is that old or new?
That's old, actually. I started raising in my apprenticeship, and that was another thing that I just got so excited about, and Charles was really into it. I enjoy large pieces and vessels. They're hard to sell, so it's a little problematic there. I have won a prize in a Saul Bell Award this year. It's actually a large fold form vessel that I made with a technique that I originated by folding copper pipe. You know, it's not completely my idea. I did it with fold forming. Elizabeth Brehm has done the inflation of metal forms, but using, you know, folding the copper pipe and then inflating it with air while you heat the copper to sort of blow up this vessel. And it has some okame in it, and it's one of my favorite pieces that I've ever done.
Well, that's really exciting about the Saul Bell Award.
Yeah, the Bell family run Rio Grande,
right.
The jewelry supply company. The company was founded by Saul, who is no longer with us, but they have created this award in his honor, which they give every year. I think they have five or six categories where they give prizes, and then a grand prize as well.
Yeah. Well, that's very exciting.
Yes. To address the larger question, yeah, I love making that big stuff. I really do. But, you know, that all takes a really long time. And unless it's sold, it's hard to give that, a disproportionate amount of time when you have to make a living.
Realizing that unless we want to earn a penny an hour, it's a little hard to make it work. So primarily, rings, wedding rings, and other wonderful smaller objects are what you're creating?
Yeah, that is what I have been doing. Certainly wedding bands are probably the most popular, and then some other pieces, brooches or pendants or whatever. And then now, I don't know if you want to get into that with this, but you know, now I'm making larger pieces through a different process that evolved out of the mokume process.
And what's that?
It's an extrusion process that I've developed. Basically, I take different forms of metal and sort of crush them in a huge hydraulic press into a billet before it's bonded. That gets sealed up in a vacuum-sealed metal canister, and then that is heated and extruded like a pasta extruder or a clay extruder.
Or a toothpaste tube is the other
that's right, yeah.
Everyday use of extrusion.
Mine would be like the stripy toothpaste, the multicolored toothpaste, where it comes out in this nice twisted stripe. The bar that comes out at the end of the extrusion has a really interesting pattern built into it.
As this stuff is being compressed in this tube, how are you able to control what goes where?
That's the trick. That is the trick right there.
I would think so.
Yeah. It's not a random kind of process. It's something that through various tools and dies that we use, we can control the way the metal folds and buckles and what sort of arrangement it takes on.
I mean, to me, it's just really fascinating. One thing for you has led to another, perhaps out of, I've kind of explored this a lot and I want a new way to play, or was it also the types of metals you were using demanded a new way to play?
Both of those. I had several things pushing me in. At the time, I had more work than I could do myself. And I had tried hiring a couple of people to help me. And I found that it took so much training to get them up to speed. I had developed my skills over a really long period of time. I knew exactly what I wanted and how to do it. And to teach that to someone else, even in a year, it was very difficult. So that was one of the reasons that I developed this extrusion process, so that there were actually steps that you could take that could be followed relatively easily, that didn't require a whole lot of skill and judgment.
And in this case, that you're able to say, put this in the tube first, this second,
that's,
this third,
that's exactly
whatever.
Right.
But they're not making the finished piece of jewelry. They're making the dough.
Right. So there was that aspect of it. And then the other thing was, as you mentioned, exploring different metals. I'd had some issues using copper alloys in my wedding bands, and I wanted to find other metals that I could use that would give me a really great color contrast with gold and silver. I ran across this metal tantalum, which is in the titanium, niobium, reactive metals family. And it's an absolutely gorgeous metal. It's a deep, deep gray color with maybe a blush of blue or sort of purple cast to it. I thought, wow, this would be fantastic to mix this in with precious metals. You know, I bought some and I stacked up a billet with it and tried to laminate it, and it just didn't work at all. It oxidized horribly, built up all these nitrides and, you know, carbides and everything else on it. And the billet just fell apart. You know, I just started reading more and more about it. I finally found out, well, this stuff, you have to work this stuff in a vacuum or a very, very, very inert atmosphere. I eventually ended up in the extrusion process because I could put that material inside and seal it in a high vacuum so that it was safe when it got heated up. Nothing would happen to it.
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX. Our guest today is Steve Midget, a jeweler, metalsmith, and as you are hearing, a very curious and inventive individual. We continue now as he discusses how he's learning about many of the industrial metals.
I was always talking to metallurgists anytime I could, and there's a network of them I kind of got hooked into, so I'd give one of them a call, and I'd explain what I'm doing, and they'd say, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, what do you want to know? You know, I can talk to you for a few minutes. So one of them told me about tantalum, and there's a lot of information in books that have been published about working with these metals, and really got more in the industrial side. Right. There is so much information and that's been done in the aerospace industry and industry just in general. In the craft world, it's pretty much untouched. You know, there are some crossovers. There definitely are, and it's made a big difference. But there's a vast body of knowledge out there that if we could build more bridges, it would really move us along as far as using different materials and techniques and things.
And what's the alloy?
Tantalum is an element.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there are some different tantalum alloys, but I use a pure tantalum.
Back in the early 80s when the price of silver started to skyrocket because the price of gold was allowed to skyrocket, really developed an awful lot of interesting variations on a theme for people,
right,
of using things such as plastic or wood or beach stones or whatever they were finding, and certainly aluminum as opposed to even copper.
Right.
But using more copper and brass as opposed to silver and certainly as opposed to gold, and then things stabled out for quite a few years, and now we're looking at $27 to $35 an ounce for silver, and I don't know what
right.
gold
$1,600
is.
$1,600 yeah. plus. Yeah. That's actually sort of the motivator for this extrusion business, is that is using more alternative metal. Titanium is $30 a pound instead of $30 an ounce. Tantalum actually is quite expensive. Still, you know, bang for your buck, you get a lot with that metal. If you've got a ring that's half titanium and half silver, well, you've saved the expense of that other half silver by using the titanium.
And in terms of a wedding ring, you have something that's got a durability to it that a lot of people don't think silver is going to give them, or a sense of preciousness, and in this case, not maybe so much the material, but the fact that you've made a beautiful object out of it, so it can become precious that way.
Yep, exactly.
I mean, it's just fun to talk with somebody who has that much sense of not being afraid to take a risk, going out there and exploring.
That is something I really believe in. It's something that I've done, and boy, I tell you, I was married for 24 years to a really wonderful person, and we are no longer married, but man, did she put up with a lot of failures, really supported me, and you know, it's just kind of the person I am. I am much more interested in exploring new things than I am in cushioning my nest so that I feel real secure. I still like to feel secure, but exploring and innovating is much more what I'm really turned on by.
I think that ability to know that you're seldom going to be in a place where you don't land on your feet gives one a sense of, okay, maybe I won't land on my feet this time, but I'll get back there soon.
Maybe that goes full circle back to where we started, you know, having that example as a child, being okay to fail or to, you know, figure something out or do it over or whatever. Yeah, I think that slowly over my work life, I have built up the capacity to fail, to change direction, to modify based on new information. And so it doesn't exactly feel like a failure. It just feels like, well, this is another bump in the road. I got to try something a little bit different.
Is that part of a way that you also move through areas where maybe creative ideas aren't a dime a dozen?
Oh, do I have dry spells as
yeah,
far
that,
as my creativity
that thing, you know,
goes?
That creativity dry spell.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely do. In fact, I've just been through quite a long one. It was really alarming to me in one way. And in another way, I knew that I just had to trust that this was just a time for that. I really don't believe in pushing through with your creativity. I believe that has to pull you. It doesn't necessarily move on your timetable. So I have learned to wait for that and to wait for that inspiration, to wait for that excitement, to wait for that interest in moving forward with something that really it's inspiration. But I have to admit, you know, after 6 or 7 months of feeling like that, I was starting to get a little alarmed. And then sure enough, you know, it was like just one little thing emerged. And I was like, yeah, I really want to explore that. I really want to start doing that. And then, you know, you start pulling on a thread, and after a while you end up, you're holding a cable, you know, and you're just connected to this big thing. I really believe in that. And for all those people out there, they're in that dip or that desolate place, just, you know, wait, just stay open. It's out there. It's coming.
I don't think I've ever had that string to cable analogy. No, I love it. I find it so interesting to realize how many people have that image that the people that they define as artists, they assume that it's always there.
Right.
That's what makes somebody an artist, that they don't have to worry about finding an idea. And that it's, I think, right, often a relief to people to realize, oh, there's a human quality here. You know, it's quite fallible and needs nourishment of all kinds.
And yes.
In your presentation the other day, you concluded it with a fairly powerful statement. Can you recap that a little bit?
I guess putting the presentation together, there was the whole technical kind of aspect of it that I wanted to deliver, and the historical references to how the technique started. But I really felt like at the end that I would be cheating the audience if I didn't talk a little bit about what I thought was really important about the making process and about the experience of making and what we can gain from it and using our hands. I just find that, one, it's extremely pleasurable when you can get into the space where you are flowing with your material and with your creation. It's like your body, your mind, your heart, your spirit, however you want to say it, are all connected in this one purpose. To me, it feels like a very spiritual kind of experience. I think there are a lot of subtle things that are happening there that help that flow along. And I think that really that working with our hands is sort of a doorway to take us to that place. And so I wanted to let people know, don't stop looking for that place, because it feeds us, you know, and we can derive great benefit. So as people's careers progress and they start getting other people working for them to do some of the grunt work, you know, I think it's really important to not just draw on paper or on a computer, you know, to keep coming back and using your hands and your eye and to make. So I think there's just incredible benefit to be derived from that.
I would agree. For me, it becomes fascinating to just find out what that power is that keeps us going.
Yes, and I really think that my work with my hands, with my craft, that it really has colored and fed the other areas of my life, you know, being able to focus like that, being able to stay open to the unfolding of a process or a design or whatever, being able to kind of roll with the punches of failure. I think that all really does help me in other areas of my life that have nothing to do with making.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I couldn't agree more, because it probably because I'm not always in my studio either, and there's sometimes been that sense of, oh, does that mean I'm not an artist anymore if I'm not there? Then I realize how many times I'm making use of problem solving and just
aesthetic decisions and everything. And I go, oh, I'm doing it all the time. I just might not be doing it with metal.
How would you feel about me reading a quote or something?
I would love it.
Would you? Okay,
yeah.
Hang on. Let me get the book. It's right here. This is from a book by Don Miguel Ruiz called The Voice of Knowledge. And I happened to read this. I finished the presentation, writing my presentation, one evening, just a couple of days before I was to present. And the next morning, I was reading this in bed before I got up for the day. And it just seemed absolutely perfect for where I was at. And I guess I have to define the voice of knowledge. He sort of speaks of it as our worldly knowledge. And he believes that a lot of it is based on lies, on things that we agree to believe in that aren't necessarily true, that things that work against ourselves. So he says, when you're creating, the voice of knowledge, or the liar, I would say, is not there. Even if you're using words in your art, if you are writing a poem, you're not thinking about the words you will use to write the poem. You are simply expressing your emotions. The words are the instrument. They are the code that you use for expression. If you are a musician who is playing music, there is no difference between you and the music. At the same time you are creating the music, you are the one who is enjoying every note, every sound. You become one with what you are doing. It is a supreme pleasure. Anyone who is a musician will know what I am talking about. You are expressing what you really are, and this is the greatest thing that can happen to anybody. Just expressing yourself leads you into ecstasy because you are creating. This is life as an art.
I'm not going to try to make that one any better than it is. Steve, thank you so much. I've really appreciated this insight and also just the fun of getting back together after it was 2000. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's really been fun for me.
In 2000, I took a summer workshop from Steve on Mogume Gane. It was a real pleasure to get back together with him. Steve's last name is spelled M-I-D-G-E-T-T. And I hope that you will do a search. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. April brings a celebration for us. 15 years on air. To celebrate, Stephen and I have a conversation with identical twin brothers, Jerome and Joel Whitkin. These internationally recognized artists, a painter and a photographer, respectively, have lived most of their lives 2,000 to 3,000 miles apart. They are not estranged, but that's just how it's been. We met with them at the Jack Rutberg Gallery in Los Angeles, where they are having the first ever exhibit of both of their work together. Our interview is the first time that they have spoken on air together. We hope that you will join us for this special event. I am Chrissy Hewitt. On behalf of my co-host Stephen DeLuque, thank you so much for listening.